Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. In last week's episode, we discussed the Goths' entry into the Roman Empire in 376 AD, how the Romans mismanaged that entry through corruption and greed, and broke their agreement with the Goths. We went over how the Goths rebelled and raided throughout the Balkan provinces of the empire, and how they inflicted a stunning defeat on the Emperor Valens at the Battle of Adrianople in 378. This was the greatest military disaster to befall the empire in more than 350 years, and there's a good argument to be made that it was the worst in its entire history and its consequences. But the Goths couldn't fight the full resources of the empire forever, and a new emperor, Theodosius, managed to slowly but surely wear them down. The Goths surrendered in 382, signing a treaty with the Romans that came close to what the two parties had first agreed on before the Goths crossed the Danube in 376. Some of the Goths were settled on farmland, while others joined the Roman army, both as individuals and in entire units. Gothic nobles took up positions as officers within the army, too, continuing the long tradition of barbarian aristocrats occupying important posts within the Roman military. This week's episode will follow the Goths from the Balkans to their shocking sack of Rome in 410 AD, the first time in 800 years that the Eternal City had suffered the indignity of foreign occupation. These Goths will end up in southern France, settled around the city of Toulouse, more than 1,500 miles from the lands they had once occupied beyond the Danube. But as we discussed last week, this isn't a story of a people on the move, of a wandering group of barbarian families who happened to cross into Roman territory, win a few battles, and then settle down like 19th century Americans heading out into the Great Plains in Conestoga wagons. The Goths weren't traveling into the unknown. They and the Romans had been dealing with each other for more than a century. Many Goths, particularly among the group that entered the empire in 376, had already served in the army, traded with Roman merchants, and otherwise touched the world of the empire. When the Goths made an agreement with Roman authorities to cross the Danube, it was according to a predetermined template that exchanged military service for safe passage and farmland. This connection between the Goths and the army is one that we'll explore in greater depth as one of the main themes of this week's episode. It would be a mistake to paint the Goths as a whole people picking up stakes and moving from place to place. The Goths, as our sources present them, are an army, and more specifically, a Roman army. It's a little more complicated than that, though. Armies in this period were expected to have wagons and a baggage train and even families along with them. That brings us to the second major theme of this episode, identity. How, exactly, did the people our sources label as the Goths think of themselves? What did they believe defined them? This question of identity has been central to how historians have thought about the Goths in particular and barbarian groups in general over the last 30 years. Ethnicity has been the major point of this argument, and to be honest, I don't think the sources tell us enough for us to have a real conversation about it in purely academic terms. This is largely why the two segments of elderly, ill-tempered professors have had such nasty things to say about each other. In the absence of much real evidence to base your arguments on, it's way, way easier to undermine your opponent's entire frame of reference, and call him a Nazi sympathizer in the process, with some tangential justification, than to actually say something meaningful about the people you're supposed to be discussing. But for the purposes of a podcast that's trying to take a more imaginative, down-to-earth view of these people and events, we have a little more freedom to speculate and entertain these thoughts without having to hold ourselves to the strict standards of academic rigor. I'll give you my views on this, which are informed by this long, god-awful debate and the theoretical literature from anthropology and sociology that inform them, but for the most part, we're going to try to stay grounded and focus on the Goths themselves. The nature of the group that we're calling the Goths is the big issue here. Was it a nation, a tribe, or an army? Is that distinction even relevant? How did the people who made up that group think of themselves? These will be the themes and questions that we weave through our story today. When we left the Goths, it was 382 AD, and they had just concluded a peace treaty with the Emperor Theodosius. The Goths were already a diverse collection by this point. They included those who had crossed the Danube in 376, who were members of a Gothic subgroup called the Tervingi, others who had crossed separately and belonged to another subgroup called the Groyotungi, miscellaneous Goths who had been members of Roman military units that had defected and joined the Gothic rebels, and then assorted slaves and marginalized people, like downtrodden farmers and miners from the Balkans, who had joined up along the way. After a little while, none of our sources ever refer to those subgroupings, the Tervingi and the Greyotungi. They're all just Goths from this point forward. Now, we don't really know how these people thought of themselves. Those are just what our Roman sources call them. But it's probably safe to say that there was a real shift in identity over the years of raiding, open warfare, running, starving, and general difficulty that marked the Gothic experience between 376 and 382. Expressions of identity embodied in labels like Tervingi and Greyotungi, which mattered a lot beyond the border where there were a whole bunch of different groups of Goths, ceased to have any meaning in a world where they were all just Goths as far as the Romans were concerned. As this period wore on and the Goths eventually settled down or were integrated into the Roman army, that broader label, Goths, became the default way of referring to these people. Old labels and group names fell away, and I'm inclined to see a real shift underlying the way our sources refer to them. To put my cards on the table, I'm making an explicit argument for the idea that identity is a fluid, negotiable, and situational construct. A person can have multiple identities in operation at the same time, and those identities can take different forms. They can be ethnic, like Roman or Goth. They can be professional, like farmer, baker, fisherman, or soldier. Or they can be regional, like someone from Italy versus someone from Gaul. Those identities can intersect with each other, too, and those points of intersection can have drastic consequences. It was much different being an urban Roman woman, for example, than a rural Roman man. Most of all, identities can be acquired and forged over the course of a lifetime, and what they mean both to the individual and to the audience that interprets those identities can shift over time and depending on the situation. So let's return to our friend Vulfila as an example. He had been born a Tervingi beyond the frontier around the year 340, and then he'd served in the Roman army in his late teens and early 20s, like a great many of his compatriots. There, in the army, he would have encountered Goths from other subgroups, like the Greyotungi we mentioned before, and various other barbarians, including Franks, Alemanni, Sarmatians, and many, many others. He would have met Romans from all over the empire, from Gaul, from Spain, from Italy, from North Africa, from the Greek-speaking East. In that context, the general feeling of being a Goth was probably more important to him than any identification with the Tervingi. When he went home and was among Goths again, though, being Tervingi probably mattered a great deal more, and the general idea of Gothicness was probably far less important. When he and other Tervingi crossed into the empire in 376 and joined up with other groups, some of which were Goths and some of which weren't, that general feeling of being a Goth probably became much more important once again. But years of fighting and campaigning, and the addition of many new people to what was effectively an army, has to have changed how that identity felt to people like Vulfila. Could the slaves and marginalized people who joined them become Goths too? It certainly seems like they did, which means that membership under that group label ceased to be a matter of descent and became one of behavior and actions. In plain terms, if you raided, stole, starved, fought, and acted like a Goth, you could call yourself one. There were probably some debates about this among the Goths. We'll never know. But group identities can be forged, and forged quickly, through adversity. The Goths faced a lot of that between 376 and 382. That fundamental fluidity of identity is something we have to bear in mind over the course of this week's episode. These Goths disappear from the record for a little while after 382. The last part of the 4th century is pretty badly documented throughout the Roman Empire, and the Balkans, a backwater by any reasonable standard, were neglected by the surviving source material even more than the rest of the empire. Reconstructing anything like a narrative of the Goths' history for the next decade or so is impossible, but it's clear that large numbers of them were recruited into the Roman army, and some nobles even achieved great success through military and political skill. For example, a pair of Gothic nobles named Fravita and Eriulf, both of them veterans of the Danube crossing, joined the military in the aftermath of Adrianople. They were both skilled and highly competent, and rose quickly within the ranks to become close associates of the Emperor Theodosius himself. That's not to say that these men were never conflicted about their service to Rome. Fravita eventually killed Eriulf at a banquet where Theodosius was present over the issue of assimilation to the Roman way of life, and Fravita went on to become Magister Militum, effectively the supreme commander of all the military forces in the East. That's how high a talented Goth with no scruples about fighting for the Romans could rise within Roman service. The army was starved for capable soldiers and officers. Manpower was a consistent problem from the 3rd century onward, and especially so in the aftermath of the defeat at Adrianople. It's not just that the Goths were a population that could be tapped for recruitment, but also that they were a legitimate talent pool. They had experience and training in the aftermath of the campaigns between 376 and 382, and that was exactly what the army needed. There's been a lot of debate among historians about the precise form that Gothic participation in the Roman army took in the aftermath of the Treaty of 382. On one end of the spectrum is the idea that the Goths fought as mass levies under their own leaders when called upon, and on the other hand is a view that the Goths joined regular units of the army as individuals. The former idea is unequivocal crap. The Romans had never done that before and had zero reason to make an exception for the Goths. I'd say the latter is still wrong, though a little closer to the mark. A great many Goths absolutely joined the Eastern Roman Field Army, and simply because of the circumstances of recruitment, many of them ended up in units that were composed mostly of Goths. The fact that their commanders may also have spoken Gothic isn't the same thing as saying that native leaders recruited their own troops and brought them to battle. This is relevant because, when we next meet the Goths, it's in a military context, the context of the Roman army. We find them under the leadership of a man named Alaric, probably the second most famous barbarian in antiquity. The combination of the Goths and Alaric would have drastic consequences for the empire.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The Goths pop up again early in the 390s, and this is when we first meet Alaric. Our sources report some kind of rebellion in the Balkans in 391, but whether this was a full-scale revolt of Gothic army units, a local uprising among settled Goths, or just large-scale banditry is impossible to say. The line between those things is something of an artificial one, and we just don't have enough information to be able to tell. Alaric first appears, according to one source, as a leader of this miniature rebellion. He even confronted the Emperor Theodosius himself, as Theodosius was crossing a river. This rebellion was quickly stamped out, but Alaric's participation in whatever this disturbance actually was doesn't seem to have harmed his career prospects. When we see him next, he was the commander of a unit of Gothic soldiers a few years later. The year 394 marked a turning point. In that year, Theodosius marched from the Eastern Empire to the Western to confront a usurper by the name of Eugenius, who was backed by the general Arbogast. Now, Arbogast is an interesting figure, and one that we'll come back to in future episodes of this show. With the benefit of hindsight, Arbogast was the first of a type that would come to dominate the history of the Empire from this point until its political end. He was the strong and capable military commander who would dominate a weak, feckless emperor. The army Theodosius took with him to confront Arbogast and Eugenius included large numbers of Gothic soldiers, including the unit that Alaric commanded. When Theodosius's forces met those of Arbogast and Eugenius at the Battle of the Frigidus, which was probably somewhere in modern Slovenia, the Goths were in the front line and took the brunt of the damage. It was a hard-won and lucky victory for Theodosius that cost many lives, disproportionately among the Gothic units of the army. The much later historian Zosimus says that Theodosius, quote, judged it most prudent to place the barbarian troops in front and to expose them first. The historian Orosius echoed that sentiment, quote, thus, in this case too, the fires of civil war were quenched by the blood of two men, leaving out of account the 10,000 Goths who, it is said, were sent ahead by Theodosius and destroyed to a man by Arbogast. For the loss of these was certainly a gain and their defeat a victory. That's strong stuff. Orosius wrote that 20 years later, and Zosimus more than a century after the fact, but there's no real reason to think that contemporaries didn't share those feelings. It's hard to imagine, too, that the Goths were somehow ignorant of those sentiments. So let's put ourselves in the shoes of our friend Vulfila here for a moment. You've now served in the Roman army for more than a decade, and served loyally, along with most of your compatriots. Sure, some Gothic soldiers were involved in a miniature rebellion a few years earlier, but what did that have to do with you? Now, you're placed in the front lines of a vicious, back-and-forth battle, and you bear the brunt of the fighting. Afterward, you notice that the politicians, and even your fellow soldiers, aren't too concerned about that loss of life. Vulfila, by this point, was in his mid-50s. He'd spent his entire life as a soldier, and he was part of a generation that was rapidly fading from the scene as age and war took their inevitable toll. These were the people who remembered life beyond the frontier, who had fought the Huns in the 370s, who had been adult warriors during the conflict between 376 and 382. Most of the men who died at the Frigidus, by contrast, were probably in their teens, 20s, or 30s. They hadn't really known much of a life outside the Roman Empire, if they could remember it at all, and the feeling of being treated like a hostile group has to have irked them. This is where Alaric comes back into play. He led one of the units of Gothic soldiers at the Battle of the Frigidus, and afterward, they were ordered back to the east. Theodosius had died, and the armies were dispersing, but the Goths never got there. Alaric, we're told, wanted a proper command, not just the unit of Goths he already had under him. We don't know much about what he'd done during the campaign that led up to the Frigidus, but it's entirely possible that this was a reasonable request. After all, the Goths had done much of the hardest fighting. We should probably read this through the lens of Alaric's ambitions, though, and the struggle for power among late Roman generals. Theodosius's death created a power vacuum. Both of the new emperors were young. Arcadius, who succeeded in the east, was 18. His brother Honorius, who took over in the west, was all of 8 years old. Both Arcadius and Honorius required a strong hand to guide them, just as Arbogast had done prior to the Battle of the Frigidus, and they found them in the persons of Rufinus in the east and Stilicho in the west. Alaric probably wanted a slot in this new order, and in the form of a band of angry Goths, he had some leverage. It's important, as we interpret the events that will follow over the next 20 years, to not overly identify the interests of Alaric and those who would follow him in leadership roles with the interests of their subordinates. Those who followed Alaric, whatever they called themselves, might have had a variety of reasons for choosing to do so. They weren't mindless drones, driven from one battlefield or negotiation to the next by the will of a strong man, but active agents in these processes. This is important to bear in mind, because Alaric's motivations are, for the most part, relatively clear. He wanted a place of importance in the imperial hierarchy, just as many other generals had throughout the last two centuries of often chaotic Roman history, and even beforehand. But what about those who followed him? At the beginning, with the unit Alaric had under his command after the Battle of the Frigidus, it's not hard to see why. They were angry at being decimated, perhaps intentionally, by their overall commanders. Alaric used that anger as a cudgel to secure for himself a better position. As with the initial Gothic revolt in 376, What started as a small rebellion soon became a regional conflagration. It's hard to follow the exact sequence of events here. No one's source gives us much of a narrative to follow, so all of this has to be pieced together from four or five different texts that don't agree on basic facts, have much different concerns and points of emphasis, and were written at drastically different times and places. The only clear thing here is that Alaric commanded a military unit that rebelled. He picked up more followers as he headed east through the Balkans, and eventually they ended up ravaging the area around Constantinople. One historian, Thomas Burns, described Alaric and his initial following like this, and I think he hits the nail on the head. Quote, clearly, Alaric did not want to return to some Gothic village from which he had been recruited, or where he had once stood watch for Rome. He and his followers at this stage were not settlers in any sense. They were malcontents, no longer under Roman command and without futures. Now, I'd take that a step further. Not only were they malcontents, they were military malcontents drawn from a particular group that had good reason to be dissatisfied. Our friend Vulfila, perhaps commanding his own group of troops drawn largely from the descendants of the Goths who crossed in 376, might have joined Alaric at this point. Other groups of malcontents, some of them Goths and others probably not, united with Alaric's hardcore of dissidents at this time. It's essential to note, though, that Alaric didn't command anything like the entirety of the Goths who had settled in this region in 382. Most historians have assumed as much, with literally zero evidence to suggest that this was the case. No source, not a single one, states that this was so. This wasn't a whole people picking up stakes and deciding to move on, but a military force comprised mostly of former Roman units that, like every other army in this period, had some families traveling with it. So this group, under Alaric's command, has reached Constantinople. But there's no way that they could take a city of hundreds of thousands of people without specialized siege equipment, which they definitely didn't possess, even if some among them had the expertise to operate it. This was probably nothing more than a show of force designed to trigger a negotiation between Alaric and the authorities, one that would end with him receiving the command he felt he deserved, and probably some sort of payoff for his troops. What that payoff might have been for the Goths is hard to say. When he didn't get it, Alaric turned south from Constantinople towards mountainous Macedonia and Thessaly along the Aegean coast, raiding as he went. Now at this point, Stilicho entered the game. We mentioned him a little earlier. He's the general who took over as the power behind the emperor in the west after Theodosius died earlier in 395. While Alaric was raiding around Constantinople and then south into the Balkans, Stilicho was heading east with both the western and the eastern armies under his command. Ostensibly, Stilicho was just doing this to deal with the threat posed by Alaric and his Goths. In reality, Stilicho claimed that he was supposed to supervise both of the new emperors, Arcadius and Honorius, and not just Honorius in the west. By marching east with the army, he would put pressure on Rufinus, the general who was fulfilling a similar role in the east as regent. As it turned out, though, Stilicho just didn't have the loyalties of the eastern army, and he was forced to let them stay under the command of a Gothic general named Gainas. When Rufinus went to inspect the troops, they killed him, and a eunuch named Eutropius took over as Arcadius's regent in the east. Because he couldn't come to an agreement with Eutropius, Stilicho was happy to head back to the west with the western army in tow. It's hard to tell how to interpret what happened next. Alaric headed south through the pass of Thermopylae, where the 300 Spartans had fought the Persians nearly 900 years before, and he operated in Greece for a while. He might have been there with the explicit permission of the Eastern court, or they might have simply decided it was more effort than it was worth to try to stop him raiding. By now it was 397, and Stilicho made an attempt to bring Alaric to heel by means of a naval expedition to Greece. Stilicho failed to corner Alaric and his Goths, but his intervention caused the Eastern court to come to an agreement with Alaric. If forced to choose between Stilicho and Alaric, Eutropius, the eunuch regent for Arcadius, would pick Alaric every time. Stilicho was, by any measure, the greater threat. So Alaric was appointed Magister Militum per Illyricum, basically the field commander of the northern army in the Balkans. His men were probably dispersed into garrisons, and we hear nothing of Alaric or the rest of his Goths for another 4 years. While our story is focused on the Goths, we have to remember that they were an afterthought. They were pawns in the greater game being played between the Western and Eastern imperial courts. Alaric was a small fry compared to Stilicho, Rufinus, or even the Gothic general Gainas, whom I mentioned earlier, and Alaric's Goths were no more consequential than any individual Roman field army, of which there were many. The fact that they could be slotted into a particular command for 4 years, in which we hear absolutely nothing about them, speaks to that fact. Now I want to stop for a second to think about what it meant for the Goths to be an army, rather than a people on the move, like something out of the fever dream of a 19th century nationalist. That's where that image comes from, whether we realize it or not. Noble, fur-clad barbarians, wives and children in tow, gazing with centuries of foresight into the new world of the Roman Empire, overturning the degenerate Mediterranean world by means of Germanic purity and vigor, and leading to a medieval rebirth. That's a product of the Romantic movement at the beginning of the 19th century, the same one whose rhetoric and ideology eventually led to the unification of Germany, and its assumptions reflect a world of eternal peoples and primordial national spirits that you could trace from antiquity to the present day. Now, an army, in that line of reasoning, was the opposite of a people. Think of strictly disciplined Prussians in identical uniforms, shorn of home and group identity, and the contrast becomes clear. But that's not what the Roman army was. The Roman army was a dynamic, centuries-old institution or series of institutions with hundreds of thousands of members that had its own social and cultural norms. Most notably, it was largely separate from the civilian world. It even had something like its own language, a basic kind of Latin interspersed with lots of slang, technical terminology, and words derived from the Germanic languages. A conversation between contubernales, technically tent mates, but more precisely comrade or buddy, might have been close to incomprehensible to a civilian. That word, contubernalis, is one that appears only in military contexts. Soldiers wore trousers, which civilians absolutely did not. Soldiers had a terrifying war cry called the baritus, which sounded something like a barbarian would yell. They wore torques and they raised their generals on shields. To be a soldier in the late Roman world was to have a distinct professional identity that separated the individual from the civilian world. Recruits in the regular army or the auxiliaries would have served for 25 years, and that's a long time in which the unit was one's home and major point of social and cultural reference. But soldier wasn't the only identity members of the army had. It was one of several. In the later Roman army, recruits came disproportionately from ethnic groups the Romans labeled as barbarians, whether they crossed the border individually to enlist, were recruited from groups settled within the empire by treaty, or were recruited as part of an agreement with a chieftain beyond the empire, like our friend Vulfila probably would have been some 30 years or so before this period. Entire units could be recruited almost entirely from a single ethnic group. Alaric's Goths weren't an exception in that regard. They may have stood out in hindsight because of what happened later, but at the time, there didn't seem to be anything unusual about their composition. Throughout the Roman army, there were cavalry units of Alani and even Huns from the steppes. There were Saxons who were starting to serve in Britain around this time. And huge numbers of Franks and Alemanni made up the core of the Western Empire's field armies. When we see barbarians within the Roman Empire, they're not peasants or farmers or fishermen or urban craft workers. They're almost invariably soldiers. But it gets even more complicated than that. My favorite historian of this period, Guy Housel, put it this way, quote, "The army was, as it had always been, a community of its own, developing its own sets of identities. What's interesting is that in the late empire, these identities were so clearly constructed around barbarian imagery." Housel goes on to say, quote, "What is clear is a late Roman confusion between soldiers and barbarians, which in many ways resulted from the military's adoption of barbarian styles." To civilians, barbarians were scary, and the late Roman army encouraged that fearful imagery. Put differently, the barbarian aesthetic was cool, and that's why the army embraced it. We talked about the special language and the trousers, but they adopted a Draco standard, basically a dragon-shaped wind puppet mounted on a long pole. They adopted that from the Sarmatians, a barbarian people. Units retained the name of barbarian ethnic groups with a reputation for ferocity, even when they were recruited elsewhere. So, for example, on the army's books, you had a regiment of Maori, Moors from North Africa, recruited in the Balkans. For a modern parallel, consider the 10th Cavalry Regiment of the United States Army. It was originally recruited as an all-African-American unit in 1866, after the Civil War, and it acquired the nickname Buffalo Soldiers during its service on the Great Plains. The 10th Cavalry Regiment still exists today, and it still has the Buffalo Soldiers nickname, but it's no longer comprised entirely of African Americans. Put in somewhat technical language, the 10th Cavalry has acquired an institutional identity in the last 150 years. That same thing happened with units of the late Roman army, which could exist in some form for literally centuries. So as the late Roman military grew more and more separate from civilian life, it became increasingly alien to the writers whose works have survived to the present day. The alien, to these writers, was inherently barbarian. To a professional poet sitting comfortably at the imperial court, or an aristocrat who spent his time at a luxurious country villa, the difference between a soldier and barbarian must have seemed difficult to discern, if not just irrelevant. Within that context, the professional identity of soldier and the ethnic identity of belonging to a particular group like the Goths or the Franks could interact in complex ways. To be a barbarian, or more specifically, to be a Goth or a Frank or an Alemanni living within the Roman Empire was almost by definition to be a soldier, and the kind of barbarian ethnic identity that grew out of such a scenario was heavily influenced by Roman stereotypes of and imagery of the barbarians. So take our friend Vulfila as an example. He's an experienced officer who's fought for and against the Romans. He spent decades in the army. He commands a unit of the Roman army composed mostly of Goths. But even those soldiers who didn't come from the group settled in 382 would have spoken a similar kind of Latin spiced with Gothic words. They would have dressed the same. They would have used the same war cry. They would have carried the same kinds of weapons. To an outside observer with no real first-hand experience of the army, who could tell the difference between Vulfila and a barbarian freshly arrived from beyond the frontier, or between the Goths by birth and those who merely belonged to the unit? I think that's what we see happening with Alaric and the Goths after 395.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great-tasting, high-quality organic dairy ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
We hear nothing from Alaric and the Goths until the year 401, when a whole series of events within the political hierarchy of the Eastern Empire created the circumstances for Alaric and the Goths to once again become headline news. As we mentioned previously, they were small fry, minor players caught within the political machinations of the elite of both the Eastern and the Western imperial courts. The fact that very shortly they'd be doing world-shaking things shouldn't blind us to the effects of hindsight here. So what happened to change the situation? Well, it's complicated, but an Eastern general named Gaiinus, whom we met briefly before, marched his troops to Constantinople to more or less demand a better deal, much like Alaric had done. Unlike Alaric, Gaiinus had a bigger army and better cards to play, and he succeeded in briefly gaining control of Constantinople and the imperial court. Didn't last long. Gaiinus happened to be a Goth, and so did many of his troops. The citizens of Constantinople rose up and slaughtered all of the Gothic soldiers stationed in the city, along with thousands of Gothic civilians, burning many of them alive in a church where they'd taken refuge. Gaiinus was forced to retreat north toward the Danube. Another Gothic officer, Fravita, who met him before killing a fellow named Ariulf at one of Theodosius's banquets, led the campaign to take care of Gaiinus, and he did so. In January of 401, Gaiinus's severed head was paraded through the capital. Fravita didn't survive for long, though, and he was executed in turn perhaps a year later. So think about this from Alaric's perspective. He's gone from being one of several generals of Gothic descent, with a loyal following and a position granted by the Eastern court, to being the last one standing. It's hard not to look at that situation and think that he had good reason to believe his own position was in real trouble in 401. So Alaric and his troops picked up stakes and headed for Italy. Many historians have tended to assume that something like the entirety of the Goths settled in 382 joined him, but there's literally no reason, as in 395, to think that that was the case. What he took with him was Alaric's army, the one he'd compiled between 395 and 397, that went with him. They hovered on the Alpine borders of Italy until 402, probably hoping to extract concessions and a new command from his old adversary Stilicho. Stilicho wouldn't bite, though, and so Alaric and his army invaded Italy in the spring of 402. Stilicho brought the Goths to battle twice, and he won a real victory at Pollentia. He captured Alaric's wife and children, along with all of the treasure Alaric and the Goths had amassed in years of plundering. The second battle, fought at Verona, the same one from Romeo and Juliet, was closer to a draw. Now, despite having stymied the invasion and fought them to a standstill, Stilicho let Alaric and the Goths withdraw from Italy to the province of Pannonia, which was a border region along the Danube, kind of modern-day Croatia, Serbia, and Bosnia. But why would Stilicho let Alaric and the Goths go? It was probably because, in the context of the tensions between the Eastern and the Western imperial courts that we've discussed, Alaric was a useful cudgel for Stilicho. Stilicho granted Alaric the same title he'd held from 397 to 401, Magister Militum, and gave his army the kind of secure posting they seem to have been looking for. Now again, it's a few years before we hear anything more from the Goths. They moved to Epirus on the west coast of Greece in 405 to prepare for a planned campaign of Stilicho's against the Eastern Empire. That campaign, though, never came to pass. In 405 and 406, the frontiers of the empire were shaken by two massive invasions. Along the Danube, a group of Goths, led by a king named Radagaisus, plunged through the border and made it all the way to Italy. And along the Rhine, a combined group of Vandals, Suaves, and Alans plunged through the defenses and made it into the heart of Gaul. To make matters worse, a credible usurper named Constantine had risen up in Gaul, and Constantine was the first priority. Stilicho responded by dealing with Radagaisus. He chased the Gothic king down near Florence, surrounded his army, and inflicted a crushing defeat. So many Goths were captured in this battle and sold that the bottom of the slave market dropped out. This will become important later, so keep this in mind. Now, it might sound strange, given the scale of the Vandal, Alan, and Suave invasion, but Stilicho was much more concerned about Constantine's usurpation. By 407, Constantine was right on the borders of Italy. Coins of his have been found in Rhaetia, more or less modern Switzerland, right on the other side of the Alpine passes Constantine would have had to take were he to invade Italy. Stilicho was right to be more concerned about Constantine than the invading Vandals, or about Alaric, for that matter. Usurpations threatened the very legitimacy of the ruler from whom Stilicho drew his power. Barbarians from across the borders couldn't really do any permanent damage. Eventually, they'd either return home or they'd be defeated. Now, into this situation stepped Alaric and the Goths. Sensing an opportunity, they moved north from Epirus into the province of Noricum, modern Austria, and demanded 4,000 pounds of gold to head to Gaul to fight the usurping Constantine. To Stilicho, this sounded like a good deal, and he convinced the Emperor Honorius to pay for what Alaric asked. Alaric would head across Italy, pick up some troops, and move through the Alps into Gaul to end Constantine's usurpation. Unfortunately for Stilicho, Arcadius, the Eastern Emperor, picked exactly this moment to die. Now remember, Stilicho had previously claimed to have been appointed the guardian of both the Western and the Eastern empires, not just the Western, and he decided that now would be a good time to press that claim. Sadly for Stilicho, who had never been anything other than competent and loyal, he fell victim to court intrigue. Honorius was convinced by a cabal of officers and aristocrats that Stilicho intended to install his own son on the Eastern throne, and Stilicho was arrested and executed in August of 408. His supporters were hunted down and killed, and so was his young son. Now, kind of in the broad scheme of things, if there was a definitive moment where the Western Empire took a nosedive from which it never recovered, I'd say this was it. Generals of Stilicho's enormous skill and strategic vision simply didn't grow on trees, and he couldn't be replaced, especially at a moment of crisis. But it's also hard to overstate how bad this was for Alaric. Whatever their disagreements or even their open battles, he and Stilicho had struck up a productive partnership over the past 7 years, and Stilicho had been a trustworthy negotiator who had followed through on his word. But in the aftermath of Stilicho's execution, opportunity struck for Alaric and the Goths. Stilicho's army within Italy, the one with which he dealt with Radagaisus, had been largely composed of barbarians. And in the aftermath of his execution, Stilicho's replacement, Olympias, ordered the murder of the wives and children of Stilicho's barbarian troops. Thousands of them were killed, and understandably, those troops abandoned the western court, Olympias and Honorius, and joined Alaric. Other new arrivals included thousands of escaped slaves, some of them Goths who had followed the dead king Radagaisus into Italy a couple of years earlier. It has to be emphasized that up until this point, the Goths had been small-time players. With Stilicho gone, his army fragmented, Alaric and his troops were the biggest game in town. Alaric and his newly strengthened Goths moved south through the Alps from Noricum into Italy itself. They went straight for Rome and laid siege to the city, eventually exacting a substantial ransom, 5,000 pounds of gold, 30,000 pounds of silver, 3,000 pounds of valuable pepper, 4,000 silk tunics, and 3,000 scarlet-colored animal skins. More importantly, they received the guarantee of negotiations with the imperial court in the West. Alaric demanded money, grain, and the position Stilicho had held, Magister Utriusque Militiae, in effect the supreme generalship in the West. He was refused, and in anger, Alaric turned back toward Rome. Before reaching the city, he made a less demanding offer, but the Western court again turned him down. Now again, for a second time, Alaric and the Goths besieged Rome, and again, they were bought off. But when Honorius again refused to negotiate, Alaric raised a puppet emperor of his own, a fellow named Priscus Attalus, as a counterweight. At this point, Honorius' position was so desperate that he offered to rule jointly with Priscus Attalus, but for whatever reason, Alaric and Priscus Attalus turned this down. Still, the possibility of negotiation was still open, and Alaric headed to Ravenna to negotiate. Something went terribly wrong. A Gothic general named Sarus, maybe acting under Honorius' orders, maybe acting out of his own interests, attacked Alaric and the Goths outside Ravenna. Fed up and convinced that Honorius was acting in bad faith, Alaric headed for Rome once more, for a third time. This time around, the city didn't buy him off, and, starving, the city opened its gates to the Goths on August 24th, 410. For the first time in 800 years, the city of Rome was being sacked. The Goths looted the city for 3 days, carrying off centuries worth of valuable goods, though they did so remarkably peacefully. Rome wasn't the capital of the empire anymore, even of the Western Empire, but it was still home to 750,000 people and a senatorial aristocracy so unbelievably wealthy that it's almost impossible for us to comprehend. This was a psychological blow of epic proportions to Romans around the empire, and at least in people's minds, it truly marked the end of one era and the beginning of another. And yet the Goths' sack of Rome was more failure than success. It only happened because of a comprehensive failure to successfully negotiate a deal. It never had to happen, and the Goths weren't suddenly better off because they had boatloads of treasure. They didn't have anywhere to spend it. They were in desperate need of food and other supplies, and Alaric and his troops were an army estranged from the only government that could give them position and a military posting. Still, though, it might not have felt that way to men like Vulfila. In all of this political maneuvering and marching throughout Italy, perhaps an old man born on the barbarian side of the Danube 70 years before might have taken some pride in the fact that he, someone who'd had to flee his home in the face of the Huns' invasions, who had once been trapped starving in the Balkans while Roman troops hunted him, was now carrying off the wealth of ages from the richest and most fabulous city anyone had ever heard of. Now sure, a negotiated withdrawal might have meant an opportunity for this elderly soldier to retire in a villa with his now substantial wealth, but maybe, just maybe, there was some satisfaction to be had in the humbling of the haughty Roman aristocrats who'd been so glad to see Goths like him die at the Frigidus 15 years earlier. Something did change with the Goths during this long series of campaigns. By the time of the sack of Rome, men like Vulfila, men who'd been born in the barbarian lands beyond the Danube, would have been few and far between. The youngest men who could remember those times would have been 40. And remember, by this point, Alaric had picked up Stilicho's barbarian troops, escaped slaves from throughout Italy, and army units that weren't wholly, if at all, composed of Goths settled in 382. This is the problem with historians who draw a straight line on a map from the Danube to the Balkans to Italy to, in a few years, southern Gaul, where these Goths would eventually find a home. The Goths fundamentally changed during these years, and we have to imagine their identities shifting, altering, being reforged. They were soldiers, they were barbarians, they were Goths, and even leaving aside the constant turnover of the people who made up Alaric's army, all of those labels were subject to renegotiation and transformation in the crucible of violence and social upheaval that marked their experiences from 395 to 410. Alaric died just a few months after the sack of Rome. There's no strong evidence to suggest he ever sought anything other than a military command, albeit an increasingly important one for himself, or anything other than a military posting for his followers. His Goths weren't done just yet, though. They eventually negotiated a settlement with the Romans and fought as a Roman army one more time, driving the Vandals and Alans out of Spain and into North Africa. The Goths were settled in Aquitaine in 418, and their commanders were no longer generals, but kings. An army had become something much more. If our friend Vulfila survived until 418, and for the purposes of this exercise we'll say that he did, he would have been nearly 80 years old. Think of the life he'd lived, a life that some Goths surely had. He was born a Tervingi, member of one particular Gothic subgroup, around 340, and came of age in a barbarian world tied with increasing closeness to the Roman Empire. He fought in its army, he returned home, and fought against the Romans. The Huns drove him and many other Tervingi to seek refuge within a Roman Empire they knew intimately, but the Romans betrayed that agreement, and at the Battle of Adrianople, Vulfila was part of one of the greatest military defeats in the history of the empire. After the Goths were forced to come to terms with the Romans in 382, Vulfila joined the army once more. He served loyally for more than a decade, alongside thousands of other Goths, but when Alaric rebelled, so too did Vulfila. He followed Alaric for 15 years, from the Balkans to the Alps to Rome itself, and in that time, he watched his comrades shrink and grow and become something entirely new. But there were few like Vulfila who'd been along for the entire journey. That's what makes the Goths interesting. This isn't a straightforward story of a barbarian migration, but one that shows just how complex the idea of a people really is. Now, I've chosen to begin this show with the Goths and the story of Vulfila because, so often, the fall of the Roman Empire is told from the Roman point of view. In this kind of telling, the Goths are savage outsiders who tear down the glories of Roman civilization. They're barbarous interlopers whom any good Roman would have cheered to see die at the Battle of the Frigidus in large numbers. But the Goths only make sense within the context of the Roman Empire. Whether we're talking about the Tervingi beyond the frontier or Alaric's Goths within the empire, they were very much the creation of imperial policies and actions. That doesn't mean, though, they didn't have agency. Throughout the story of Vulfila, I hope we've gained a little perspective on the humanity of these people and how they might have experienced these events, events that are so often given weight only because of how they affected Rome and the Roman Empire. Next week, we'll turn our attention from the Goths to the empire itself. In the first four episodes, we've danced around one of the central issues that we have to face when evaluating the later Roman Empire. Just how screwed up was it, really? Was the empire of the 4th century, the empire of Valens and Theodosius, a fundamentally healthy state? Or did it contain within it the seeds of its own destruction? Thank you for joining me for today's episode. If you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman. And if you have questions, comments, concerns, or if you just want to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire, drop me a line. Until next week, thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.